everybody, and welcome to another episode of Broken Bread, where we're studying the letter to the churches in Galatia, and we're actually up now to study number 27, and there's a little bit of a diversion ahead for us tonight. The topic tonight is, what is man? And then, number one, the first man. So what are we doing? Well, in our journey, we now come in sight, in my imagination, of a high mountain peak. It looks like a tough climb. But if we make the climb, we'll have a panoramic view of the next parts of our journey. We'll see where the roads and the rivers are, and hopefully we'll be better equipped for the journey ahead. So, in good John Bunyan style, we're heading for the town of Conflict in the county of Galatians. This is the verse that we're right on the threshold of in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 17, where Paul begins with the word for, which shows that really it flows on from the previous statements. But he says this, for, this is the American Standard Version. He says, for the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, for these are contrary, the one to the other, that ye may not do the things that ye would. I've gone for the American Standard Version, this time in the New Testament, for a particular purpose. And what I'm planning to do is to do what people would normally call a diversion, or some of my old friends would call a typical one of Ron's rambles, or which the students sometimes call an excursus. That means we're going to go sideways for a while to look at something before we move on. And I want to look at the war and the way it's been declared. So tonight I'm going to talk about the nature of the war, and then we're going to go on next week, God willing, to the Battle of Eden, like a proper war story this. The Battle of Eden, then number two will be the Battle of Judea, then number three will be the Battle of Caesarea Philippi, and then number four will be the Battle of Gethsemane. And in those things, we shall see an outworking of these principles, of what it says here, where it says the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. For these are contrary the one to the other, that you may not do the things that you would. So what's the nature of this conflict, and why are we doing this? Well, because in a sense, although we can just jump in at any point in Galatians, remember context, context, context. And there's a wider context here, because this is in the context of the whole drama of the world's history and the history of mankind, the drama of redemption. And that begins a long, long time ago. Maybe you remember this encounter between Jesus and the Pharisees. It says, this is Matthew 19. It says, the Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, or separate. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And then he went on to say other things. But it's this amazing statement here that Jesus makes a statement. They go back to Moses, you see, that's what they're doing. The Pharisees are going back to Moses, and they say, well, this is what Moses said. Jesus goes back to the, in effect, from earlier. It's almost as though they go back to the Sinai covenant at Sinai, and he actually, in effect, says, you can't start from there. You've got to go farther back to understand what all this is about. But from the beginning, it was not so. And there's a sense here in which we have to go back to the beginning and even prehistoric beginnings to understand what is happening here and how this conflict that we experience day by day with the flesh lusting against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh, to understand how that fits in. How do we explain that? So this is what we're going to do. So I'm going to spend a little time, first of all, looking at what I call the first man. When God gives the revelation to Moses of the creation, it begins like this. This is Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26 following. God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." I'm going to jump a little bit. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. That's the old King James Version. So this is the creation of a species that would be in the image and likeness of God. There'd never been anything like this before. There are angels who are referred to at one point as the sons of God. They obviously have a likeness to God, but they have no corporeal aspect. They have no body. And this is something different, that God began a work in physical things, in corporality. But this thing, this species, which was actually going to be perceivable from the outside as flesh and blood, actually would be something really almost beyond our imagination. It would be in the image and likeness of God. Primarily that means inwardly, but we'll go on to say something else. So, and it goes on in chapter 2 to say this, "And Jehovah God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." That's just a very short verse, but it's absolutely packed with information. It tells us, first of all, for example, that Jehovah God formed man. Now, coming from the potters as I do, I love this word because it's actually the word potter. It's to make a pot. So God potted man. That's to say, he created man, he crafted man of the dust of the earth. I'm very pleased to know that the very first trade referred to in the Bible is that of a potter. My family generations go, I've traced them back to the late years of the 1700s, and on my father's side, every single one of them was a potter of one kind or another. So God crafted man of the dust of the ground, and that's body, that's physicality. Then it says this, "He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life." Now, this could also be translated, "He breathed into his nostrils the spirit of life. And in fact, this is something that doesn't come out through any version that I know of, but it's there very plainly in the original Hebrew. The word life here is actually in the plural. So it actually says, "He breathed into his singular nostrils the breath of lives." And that opens up really an amazing concept. We were all in Adam. All our lives were in Adam. God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became. This clay form that had been carefully crafted by God, I don't suppose it means with his hands, it's just a Bible picture of saying the way God did this thing. There was a plan, there was a process, and there was a finished product. And that finished product was man. And into that being, God breathed into his nostrils, he breathed the spirit of lives. And the man that up until that point had been earth and clay and physical became a living soul. Wow. So the Spirit of God comes into this thing that God has crafted, and something takes place. The first man appears. This is what some people call homo divinus, I think, or something like that. The first man that comes from God. Okay, so let's move on a little bit. The question that's asked sometimes, and we'll see it in a moment from Psalm 8, is, we need an answer to the question, what is man? Well, there's one answer to it. That's how he came into being. He is dust and destiny. He is earth and amazing prospect. He is really a phenomenal creation of God. He is the masterpiece, the summit of the creation as we have the revelation of it in the book of Genesis. He is body and spirit and soul. And if I may borrow, take it out of its context, some of the words of Jesus that I spoke earlier, he is body and spirit and soul, and what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And I would also add, be careful how you join the dots. There are all kinds of words that are used to express functions of the inward man. You've got body, that's the outward man. Then they've got soul, spirit, heart, flesh, mind, conscience, strength, reins. That's to say, in the sense of the heart and the reins. Be careful how you join the dots. Don't be too hasty in dividing body and spirit and soul. The letter to the Hebrews says that only the Spirit of God, the Word of God, can actually make that distinction between spirit and soul. So God has created this man, and obviously he has created him for a purpose. Is he fit for the purpose? That's the question. What's the purpose? This is David in the Psalms, Psalm 8. I imagine him as a young teenager here, lying on his back looking up at the stars while he's tending the sheep. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? You have made him but little lower than God, or the angels, as some versions say, and crowned him with glory and honour. You make him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under his feet. This is the Holy Spirit speaking by the mouth of David. He's God's vision statement for the human race. First of all, let's see what God's role in it is. Well, he is mindful of the creature that he has created. He's in his thoughts every day, all the time. And then it says, and the Son of Man that you visit him. In the Septuagint, that's the old Greek version of the Bible, the word that's used here is the word episkopao, which really is the word we get episkopos from, which means to oversee. So God does two things. He's mindful of man, he's considerate of him, and he visits him, if you like this word, but he appraises him. I don't know whether you've ever been in a job where you had annual appraisals. I have, and I've also been in a job where I had to give annual appraisals, and they're pretty kind of nail-biting experiences very often. But God does visit us. It's interesting, maybe you know this, that there are two men in the Bible who ask this question, what is man? The first one is Job. And when Job asks the question, he asks it from the sense of being absolutely hemmed in, hedged in, he complains. Both Satan and Job complained that they were hedged in by God. Satan complained that he couldn't get in, and Job complained that he couldn't get out. And that's one of the aspects of this idea of visiting. And Job's complaint is, why does God keep coming and bothering us, if you like? What is man that you are mindful of him, and the Son of Man that you visit him, that you appraise him? And then it comes unto man. Let me read this thing. You have made him a little lower than the angels. Let's pick out these words. Made. That's that word, potter, again. You've crafted him, but a little lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honour. You've made him to have dominion. You've given him a commission. You've given him a task. You've put all things under his feet. You've made him a more than conqueror. Let's put all those C's together, shall we? God is mindful and constantly appraises us, constantly watches over us, measuring us against his will. Man is created. He was crafted, crowned, commissioned, conquering. Let's have a look at the commission. This is Genesis chapter 2 and verse 9. Out of the ground, God, the Lord God, made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight. Now that word pleasant is going to become important to us. because it really means to desire something. God made man, and he made the earth in a way so that man would desire it. That's how this word can be translated. It can be translated of improper desires, illegal desires. It can be translated to mean legitimate desires. So out of the ground, the Lord God made to grow every tree that was desirable, that man would long to see the sight of it. You see, God has put not just a capacity, but a basic need in us for beauty. We need beauty. We need, there's something in us that rises to beauty. And landscapes and mountains and rivers and sea and all kinds of things. This is how God made us. He designed us to desire beauty. That'll be important. There are some religions who teach that their goal is to eliminate desire. Buddhism, of course, does that. Aspects of Hinduism do that. Their ultimate goal is to eliminate all desire, especially the desire to come back into another reincarnation. So if you can eliminate all desire, you pass into nirvana, and that's it. Your cycle is over, and you're one with the one spirit of the universe. So they say. It's in direct contradiction to the scripture. God has given us desires, but they're desires that can only be exercised in a legitimate circumference, a circle in which those desires are to be lived out. So God doesn't negate humanness. God created it and God endorses it. We'll come back to that in a moment. Here's another thing from Genesis chapter 1 and verse 28. And God blessed them, that's the couple, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. I can see two things in there. First of all, God said, be fruitful and multiply. First of all, we were designed, if you like, to desire beauty. We were also designed and equipped for reproduction so that we could fulfill this blessing and purpose of God in being fruitful and multiplied. These are not wrong impulses. These are not wrong desires. These are God-given desires. These are what it means to be human, to have these desires, to different degrees in different people. And then if you saw that little bit there, it says to subdue it, to have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And that comes in line with this other statement here. This is Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15. I would encourage you to look at these first two chapters, because this is man without sin. This is Adam without an old Adam. This is Eve without an old Adam. This is man in his innocence, blessed, equipped with strong desires for beauty and order, for reproduction. And he is part of the commission. Chapter 2, verse 15. And Jehovah God took the man and brought him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. Okay, that gives us the picture. Let me dig deeper a little bit and take some of the Hebrew words. I don't know much Hebrew, but I've got the tools that can take me down into it. Here's the first thing. When it says put him in the garden, literally it says in the Hebrew, caused him to rest in the garden. That's interesting, isn't it? God created man, and the first thing he did was cause him to rest in the Garden of Eden. You see, we tend to think of working 6 days and then having one day to rest. Man's first day was the seventh day. So he started with a rest, like a British plumber or electrician. Or no, I'm only teasing. I've got some very good friends who are plumbers and electricians, so I have to be very careful. But God comes and this is what he does. He takes man and he causes him to rest in the garden that's in Eden. And then this is why he does it. He does it to, now, a normal version say to dress it. This is the Hebrew word Ahab, and it actually is used, I think, a couple of hundred times in the Old Covenant scriptures. But it's nearly always translated to serve. So let's put that into this statement. Jehovah God takes the man, causes him to rest in the Garden of Eden, to serve it. Really? I thought he had dominion over it. Yes, that's why he has dominion over it. So not so that he can lord it over it, but so that he can serve it, so that he has the authority to care for it, to order its way, to use it in the way and lead it in the way. And this one too. He's the third one. Jehovah God takes the man and causes him to rest in the Garden of Eden, to serve it and to guard it. Keep it, the old versions say. Keep it. So how about this then for a job definition? He takes the man, he causes him to rest in the Garden of Eden with the prospect of serving it and guarding it. You see, man was not only designed to desire beauty, not only was he designed and equipped for reproduction, but he was designed and crafted for service and conflict. He was designed for conflict. There's a lovely line in the story of the film of Eric Liddell. You know, this was the Olympic runner who had an amazing turn of speed, and he ran in a very ungainly way. His arms were all over the place and his head went farther and farther back, and you'd think, how can this man kind of even walk in this position, let alone actually win things? And someone said to him on one occasion in the film, and I hope it's true, I hope this is a bit of research that they dug up, in the film they say, why is it you run so fast? And Eric Liddell says, I don't like to be beaten. Oh, do listen to that. He doesn't say because I like to beat others. He says because I don't like to be beaten. Man was created with a disposition and crafted for service and conflict, but it's built into him the desire not to be beaten. He was not intended to lay down and die when the first attacks came against him, nor was he intended to yield. He was intended to stand and fight. He was intended to guard. What happened in that first conflict? You know this story well, Genesis chapter 3 we've come to now. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Jehovah God had made, and he said to the woman, yes, has God said, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? The woman said to the serpent, of the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as God, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight, that's that word desire, that it was desirable to the eyes, she saw the beauty of it. She saw that it was desired to make one wise. Instincts that were in her, desires that were in her, were activated. But now what will she do, this innocent woman? She's not holy. That's a mistake to call her holy, or Adam at this stage. They are innocent. In her innocence, what will she do with this strong desire to look and this strong desire to know the difference between good and evil? You see, there's nothing wrong in looking at beauty. There's nothing wrong in wanting to make progress in our understanding of things. Nothing wrong with that. She did all these things and had not yet sinned. And she saw that, the tree was desirable to make one wise. And up to this point, she has not sinned. Up to this point, her desires are operating. She's looking, she's thinking, Then she took of the fruit, now she is in deadly danger. And she did eat of it, now she sinned. And she gave also to her husband with her, and he did sin. Not difficult to identify the dragon, the serpent, of course. It says in the book of Revelation, so the great dragon was cast out, that ancient serpent called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So who are these adversaries? We've looked at man, this creature, this splendid creature, this amazing creature who was crafted, crowned, commissioned, conquering, ready for what God had for him to do. And now we see this creature, because that's what he is. He is a phenomenally powerful creature, but he is a creature. He is not a creator. He cannot create. He can destroy. He can distort. He cannot create. Let's put these adversaries side by side. There are two passages in the Old Testament which give us, I believe, amazing insights into prehistory. One is in Isaiah chapter 14, where Isaiah is actually bringing a condemnation against Babylon. And he speaks about the ruler of Babylon, but then his prophecy seems to kind of take off when it goes into another dimension. And you discover that he's not addressing just the physical king of Babylon, but he's actually seen through him and he's addressing the power behind the throne. And listen how he describes the power behind the king in Babylon. How art thou fallen from heaven? This is Isaiah 14. How art thou fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground that didst lay low the nations? You said in your heart, that the Bible phrase meaning you thought these things. All of our thoughts are open to God. He hadn't said a word, he hadn't done a thing, but in his heart he was thinking. You said in your heart, and then you've got five statements here that begin with the phrase, I will. I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the uttermost parts of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. Now all these are kind of pictures, they're metaphors, they're things that had relevance for the people of the day, because this is the place of God's dwelling, because there was an earthly place of God's dwelling, which was where God was in the temple, but beyond that, there's a spiritual reality to it. And then the last of the five, I will make myself like the Most High. The same lie that he fed into that first innocent couple. If you do this, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. You will no longer be dependent upon God for your information, no longer to be dependent upon God for revelation. From this point on, you will be free. You'll be able to go wherever you want to go, no longer tied to God's apron strings. I will, I will, I will, I will, I will. In the Garden of Gethsemane, and we shall come to it, God willing. Lord, if it's possible, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, my desires. That's the word lusts. Not my longings, but your longings. And this one, from Ezekiel, a longer one. Moreover, this is about the powers behind the king of Tyre this time. Moreover, the word of Jehovah came to me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre, and say to him, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Who is this he's describing here? The king of Tyre was never in Eden, the garden of God. He's seen through the king of Tyre, and he's actually speaking of the power that's behind him. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering. The sardius, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tabrets and of thy pipes was in thee. In the day that thou wast created, they were prepared. Thou wast the anointed cherub that covers, and I set thee, so that thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the days that thou wast created till unrighteousness was found in thee. By the abundance of thy traffic, Tyre was a great mercantile nation. By the abundance of thy traffic, they filled the midst of thee with violence, and thou hast sinned. Therefore, I have cast thee as profane out of the mountain of God, and I have destroyed thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Thy heart, here we go again, God knowing the heart, thy heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. This is the original sin, and this is as far back as we can go. At some point in prehistory, this supreme angelic being became self-conscious. Instead of joining the chorus of the other four who night and day worship God in absolute adoration, holy, 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 this one became self-conscious. I don't know how. Thy heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I have cast thee to the ground. I won't read any more, but it's, you can see the pictures. These are dramatic pictures, and they speak of a servant of God, a supreme being, who at some point in prehistory, before time as we understand it, it seems to me, rebelled against God and took with him a vast number of the angelic beings too. So these are the adversaries, a supreme being whose power to our human senses is immeasurable, who is greater in power, status, might, wisdom, understanding. And he's Adam, for it was his role initially to withstand him and guard the garden. Here comes Adam. It's almost like it's a prequel of David and Goliath. This puny creature, but God blessed and God commissioned. And he could have stood against him. And then we would pass him to a whole series of what ifs and what ifs. And there's no point in going there. It's sheer speculation and there's no profit in it. And we know the story. And I'm going to ask you to read the story. Chapter 3, Galatians of Genesis, next week. And we'll come to it. And we'll examine the battle of Eden. Okay, so we're starting to climb our mountain. I hope you'll stick with me and get to the peak. You'll have an amazing glimpse of why it is that there is a continuing conflict between the strong desires of the flesh and the strong desires of the spirit. I've overrun my time. Sorry about that. I'll stop. Thank you for joining me. God bless you, and God willing, and I won't say equipment permitting, because God willing includes all those kind of things. God willing, I'll see you the same time, same place, next week. Bye-bye.